Well, good evening. I'll draw your attention to a statement made that's familiar to us in Acts the 17th chapter and verse 11. Speaking of those in Berea, it says that these were more noble-minded than those in Thessalonica, for they received the word with great eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see whether these things were so. We find varying attitudes in Acts chapter 17. At the very beginning of the chapter, we have some staunch Jews who were unwilling to listen to anything they had not already heard. They accused Paul and his companions of upsetting the world, and even so, there were some persuaded by the truth. Paul had reasoned from the scriptures and explained and gave evidence about Jesus. At the end of chapter 17, we find kind of the opposite attitude, marked by a clear desire only to hear new things. In verse 21, the Athenians would gather only to hear new things. So you have at the beginning, tell us only what we've already heard, and at the end, tell us only what we haven't heard before. And while they were willing to let Paul speak, the reaction to the resurrection teaching, of course, was mixed. Now, some don't want to hear anything new, and others only want to hear new things. There's a better, more honorable attitude exemplified here by the Bereans in verse 17. They were noble, they were eager, willing to examine what they heard to make sure that what was being taught was the truth. And the chapter really shows that it doesn't matter how old something is or how new something is to our ears. What matters is whether or not it's true. And we don't seek the old because it's old or the new because it's new. We seek the truth because it's right. And finding truth is rewarding in itself. And the importance of truth to the child of God should be pretty clear. It's highlighted by many passages. But, for example, John 8:32, you shall know the truth shall set you free. Ephesians 4:20 and 21, you did not learn Christ in this way, if indeed you have heard him and been taught in him, just as truth is in Jesus Christ. At John 1 and verse 14, the word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we saw his glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. John 1:14 again. John 14 and verse 6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. Or John 17:17, sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. Psalm 119 and verse 160 says, the sum of your word is truth. We could continue all night talking about passages that bring up truth. The question here is, how do we determine truth? Now, when we talk about determining something, we're talking about deciding or concluding that something is true. And determining can carry the logical meaning of limiting the idea by adding kind of differentiating characteristics. In other words, understand that there are boundaries around what we consider to be truth rather than just accepting anything and everything. There are boundaries around truth. 1 John 4 and verse 1 reminds us, beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits whether they are from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. In other words, we're searching for truth, but we're not to be gullible. We don't accept everything as the truth. According to Time Magazine Online, in 2016, Oxford's word of the year was post-truth. Think about that for just a moment. Post-truth was the word of the year in 2016. And according to that article, post-truth, quote, describes a situation in which feelings trump facts. It's called, quote, an apt choice for countries like America and Britain, where people live through divisive populist upheavals that often seem to prize passion above all else, including facts. The definition they give for post-truth is this, relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. In other words, we are in a post-truth era where truth itself really doesn't matter so much. The facts don't really matter so much. What matters are our feelings, the passion that we may have, our what's inside of us. That's what really matters. That word actually dates back to 1992, according to that article, but Oxford saw its usage explode by 2,000% in 2016. And they're applying that primarily to the political climate of our age. And then they suggest, quote, it may become the defining word of our time, post-truth. And that was initially, again, noticed in a more political context. But it's not difficult to see how that term can broadly fit the way culture has been moving for some time. And that includes the way people think about religion. So the terminology may be shifting somewhat, but the problem presented here is nothing new. The term that you might have heard before, that's sometimes referred to the same basic idea, is postmodernism. Again, it's a term that describes a shift in thinking in which people create their own inward truth. There's no objective truth, it's just what you create inwardly. And objective facts are met with suspicion. So if you say this is an objective fact, they're going to say, I don't think so. Everything they say, including truth, is relative. And that also means then that tolerance needs to be accepted for all things. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? There's not really any ultimate objective truth, and you got to be tolerant of everything, unless it involves people who believe there's objective truth to which everyone is amenable. So post-truth and postmodernism are basically the same thing. But truth is seen as an outdated notion. People don't know that they can call anything truth. All they know is what they can feel. Now, there was a time when we could reasonably expect people to have a common agreement on the idea that truth is discoverable. But now many don't even agree that there's such a thing as truth at all. Post-truth advocates have outgrown the idea that there's truth. And so intuition is going to tell us more than evidence will. We just need to go with our feelings and forget about trying to convince others that there's an object of truth and try to persuade them of that. So again, I hope you understand that this is something that's going on in culture. It should sound familiar to you. In this post-truth, post-modern view, traditional morals and viewpoints are seen as oppressive. Advocates may think they're being spiritual, and they wouldn't necessarily say it's wrong to be religious, but the key is that you just have to keep your religious views and your moral views completely to yourself. Why? Because if you present your views as absolute truth, you will oppress those who feel differently. And of course, one of the worst things we can do today is hurt someone's feelings. Regardless of how wrongheaded those feelings may be, there's little value given to the idea that perhaps our feelings ought to be challenged and that our feelings can actually be wrong and lead us in wrong directions. So we can see why post-truth, the concept, is going to be at odds with biblical Christianity. God is the ground and source of truth. And all the works of God in His hands are, as Psalm 111:7 says, truth and justice. The truth of the Lord is everlasting, Psalm 117:2 says. And the fundamental nature of truth is at stake. So again, when Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, if there is no such thing as truth, there is no salvation. I am the way, the truth, and the life can only be meaningful if truth is objective and applies equally to everyone. A truth that is not objective cannot stand or cannot make anyone free. So the idea of post-truth is anti-biblical, anti-God, anti-Christ. And Christians can fall into that same post-truth kind of trap if we don't keep up our guard. We can fall prey to the notions that our feelings matter more than the actual facts, more than truth itself. And people treat religion, again, as if it's something that's at their whim. God is just supposed to rubber stamp the way we feel about things. And that can be most egregious. For under the guise of serving God, we may well be creating idols out of our feelings. So our question here is how to understand truth when we hear it. Not only do we need to know the truth, but to be aware of the nature of truth in order to determine whether truth is what we're actually hearing or seeing. In other words, determining truth requires knowing some fundamental things about the nature of truth. So let's talk about that a little bit. First, I want to point out that truth is rooted in reality. Knowledge requires truth. You can't really say you know something if it's not truth that we're talking about. To say I know is to implicitly claim what is known to be as true. Otherwise, the knowledge means nothing and the claim is pretty much hollow. So if what is known is not truth, then saying I know something but it's not truth makes no rational sense. And truth and reality then are necessarily tied together. For if something is not real, it cannot be truth, nor can it be known in any actual sense. We may even hear someone say today, there is no such thing as truth. To which we should simply ask, is that true? Do you know that to be true? That's a self-defeating position, and it yields only confusion and hypocrisy. If the statement there is no truth is true, then it's false. And if it's false, then it's false, right? Either way, it's false. I mean, that's the point. Either way, it's false. It can make no rational sense. The only reasonable position is to accept that truth is real. Because when someone says there is no truth, they're making a truth claim about truth. But if we're going to know something is true, we need to know what is real. There's no sense in talking about the truth of something unless what we're talking about is grounded in reality. For example, in discussing morality, some atheists will argue that moral values are illusory rather than real. They argue that morals have evolved merely to help us survive, but they're not actual, they're not objective. And that view makes discussion of truth relative to moral values pretty meaningless. Atheist Michael Ruse said this, "Considered as a rationally justifiable set of claims about an objective something, it, ethics, is illusory. I appreciate that when someone says, 'Love thy neighbor as thyself,' they think they're referring above and beyond themselves. Nevertheless, to a Darwinian evolutionist, it can be seen that such reference is truly without foundation." That's an ironic statement. It's truly without foundation. "Morality," he says, "is just an aid to survival and reproduction and has no being beyond or without this." He says, "Morality is an ephemeral product." That means temporary. It's not permanent. It's a temporary product of the evolutionary process, just as are other adaptations. It has no existence or being beyond this, and any deeper meaning is illusory. Richard Dawkins took a similar position when he wrote, "The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference." Reality is fundamental to understanding and determining truth. When Jesus said, "I am the truth," he was speaking of what is actual. He's not only teaching truth, he is truth. If his identity is not rooted in who he really is, the reality of it, then teaching that he is the truth would make no sense. If he is who he claimed, then he is real and he is the only truth that can save us. So it's real. Now, tied to that is the idea of it being objective. Many today are fond of arguing that truth is subjective. And what we're talking about here is the idea that something that's objective is outside of ourselves. This podium is an objective thing. It's not. I hope I'm not just making it up. If I am, let me know because I'm worried. But it's really here. And I think it's made of wood, and you know, we can describe it and feel it and see it. And all this is objective to me. It's outside of me. So when we talk about something objective, it's outside of ourselves. We're talking about something subjective, it's within ourselves. It's what I feel. It's what I think. And that's a very different thing. So when we're talking about objective versus subjective, we've got to understand that difference. So truth is objective. Again, many people are fond of arguing that it's subjective. Postmodern philosophy sees truth, again, as something we create within ourselves, not something that is objectively the case. But if truth is real, then it also must be objective. That is, it stands outside of ourselves and is true whether or not we believe it or accept it. That truth existed whether or not I existed. How we feel about that changes nothing. Truth is truth whether we like it or not, or whether we feel a certain way about it or not, doesn't matter. That's not the point. It's still going to be the truth. I could get up here and tell you, well, this podium isn't really here. And you're just saying some kind of an illusion. And you're going to think, I've lost it somehow. Because you're going to say, this is a real thing. And that's my point. It's objective. It's outside of ourselves. That's the nature of truth. And the nature of truth, the objective nature of it, can be seen in a passage like Galatians 1, 8, and 9, when Paul, in his message to the Galatians, said that even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to what we have preached to you, he's be accursed. As we've said before, so now I say again, if any man is preaching to you a gospel contrary to what you received, he is to be accursed. He can only say that if the truth is objectively the case, if it's out there. It's not just you violated something I feel, but you have violated something that is objectively true because it comes from God. So there is an objective standard to which we may appeal. The gospel here that has been preached, that's the standard. If something runs contrary to what has been revealed, he says, let it be accursed. Sometimes people will claim to have seen an angel or some kind of vision telling them what to do or believe. And of course, that's never verifiable, and there's no way for us to cross-check that because they're making a statement about what they think they've experienced. But Paul's point here would apply. Because my question to them would be, what is it saying to you then? Is it in line with what the gospel says, or is it something else? Paul says if it's not what the gospel is that's already been revealed, then let it be accursed. That's the point. Why? Because it is an objective standard to which we may appeal and which we can know. Feelings cannot be challenged. If you come to me and say, you know, I feel a certain way, I can't challenge that. Okay, those are your feelings. Objective truth claims can be challenged. So if somebody comes to me and says, well, you know, I just feel that this is a good thing. Well, I can't challenge your feeling. But I can challenge the objective truth claim as to whether or not it's good. And that points us back to the Word of God as our standard. Just Paul wrote to the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 13. 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 13. For this reason, we also constantly thank God that when you received the word of God, which you heard from us, you accepted it not as the word of men, but for what it really is, the word of God, which performs its work in you who believe. It doesn't use the word truth right there, but you get the idea. You're accepting it for what it really is, the word of God, the objective standard that does its work in us. So there is a real danger here of putting feelings over the truth. Now, let's understand that feelings are a vital part of who we are. God gave us emotions. God gave us feelings. We're not denying that. We all have them. We all nurture them. None of us wants our feelings to be injured and hurt. But there's a great danger here. Because feelings have a proper place, but we need to be aware of the danger that comes from allowing our feelings to win out over the facts. The facts of sin do not change because our feelings about those sins change. We're always in danger of falling deeper into sin based upon how we feel at the given time. And once we allow our feelings kind of to hold sway, we begin to rationalize the way we look at that sin. It's not that bad, we may think. The old song expresses that problem. If loving you is wrong, I don't want to be right. But that's exactly the danger expressed in James chapter 1, verses 14 and 15. James 1, 14 and 15. Each one is tempted when he's carried away and enticed by his own lust. And when lust is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Outward, overt sin occurs because of what starts in the heart. Our feelings are leading us away into these desires so that we commit the acts of sin. And that's true in our own personal lives regarding the temptations that face us. It's also true in how we might try to rationalize sin on behalf of others. Maybe a family member gets carried away in sin, so we begin to rationalize that. Well, it's not that bad. If you've paid attention to discussions over matters like gay marriage, transgenderism, or abortion, you may have noticed that the leading factor is how people feel about it. They're not really making objective arguments. They're saying this is the way we feel and we can't challenge their feelings. And that's true. We can't really challenge it. This is the way they feel. I can't challenge that. But that's a different question from whether these things are correct and right objectively. And those are the things we have to look at. Little appeal to objective facts. And when objective facts are brought up, those facts are often shot down with that just goes against our feelings. Doesn't really matter what biology shows. If you feel a certain way, you should just go with it. And when feelings take the lead, many other problems come with it. So there are feelings, and it's in our feelings that we can address the same issue here. If I feel angry, shouldn't I be able to express that? If I feel a sense of bitterness, shouldn't I be able to express that? If I feel vitriol and violence, shouldn't I be able to express that? Those feelings are being expressed, and it's those feelings that cause others to bully, push, insult, and kill. It's feelings that cause us to avoid the calm reflection in favor of irrational outbursts. And that is expressly stated to be foolish in Scripture. For example, Proverbs 12 and verse 15 says, "The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man is he who listens to counsel. A fool's anger is known at once, but a prudent man conceals dishonor. He who speaks truth tells what is right, but a false witness deceit. There is one who speaks rashly like the thrust of a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing." So you have this outburst of feelings on the one hand that's foolish versus the calm, reflective wisdom as described here. Proverbs 14 and verse 29, 14, 29 says, "He who is slow to anger has great understanding. He who is quick-tempered exalts folly. A tranquil heart is life to the body, but passion is rottenness to the bones." Again, just the outbursts, the feelings that lead us into these outbursts of anger and other things. "A hot-tempered man stirs up strife, but the slow to anger calms a dispute," Proverbs 15:18 says. So the conundrum of our culture is, on the one hand, we're supposed to go with our feelings, but on the other hand, it's those feelings that lead to the very problems of abuse and bullying that our culture is so desperately trying to fight. With one hand, we feed the beast. With the other hand, we try to kill the same beast even while we're feeding it. And a look at social media is sufficient to see that. Post-truth views will always fail because they will appeal to the very thing they deny. Once again, "There is no truth" is a truth claim about truth. It is self-defeating. "You ought to go with your feelings" is a moral ought statement that is based upon a subtle, objective truth claim that feelings are more important than facts. But C.S. Lewis wrote, "And when you're arguing against Him, against God, you're arguing against the very power that makes you able to argue at all. It's like cutting off the branch you're sitting on." Feelings are dangerous when we allow them to hold more power than truth. The truth is discoverable. If it's real, if it's objective, then it's something that we can pursue and discover. It can be investigated and found. It's something that can be searched for. It's something that can be studied. It's something that can be known. And God made us, as we talked about this morning, God made us with minds that can reason and think and discover and learn. We are not mere robots. But we've been made with the desire and the need to reason. As we grow and mature in our thinking, we ought to be able to discern between good and evil, as Hebrews 5:14 tells us. And I would just once again remind us of what we read this morning from Luke chapter 1, 1 through 4. We read a couple times where Luke talks about the gospel account that was handed down from the beginning by eyewitnesses and servants, and I've investigated everything carefully from the beginning, so that you may know the exact truth about the things you have been taught. Luke 1, 1 through 4 tells us. So if we desire to know the truth, then we will search for it. And we can discover it. Which then brings us to the corollary that it's attainable. We can discover it, but we can then attain it and own it. We understand that there can be truth that is undiscoverable to us. For example, there are aspects of God and His knowledge that we never will attain. Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 20 reminds us that God is able to do far more abundantly beyond anything we can ask or think. God has capability to do things that we're incapable of thinking. And so there is truth that resides in God that is beyond our ability to know, but this is not to be understood to mean that truth cannot be attained. What we're discussing here is that which was within our reach, that our search will not be in vain. It will be a valuable thing and vital part of who we are. But that also would mean that truth is understandable. Like Paul told the Ephesians in Ephesians 3, "When you read, you may understand my insight into the mystery of Christ." So once again, as Jesus made that statement in John 8 and verse 31, "If you continue in my word, you are truly disciples of mine, And you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. And in that context, it's freedom from sin. You'll be free from sin if you follow Him. Truth makes us free from that. And discovering truth will be more valuable and long-lasting than anything else that we can do, because again, ultimately, to find truth is to find Jesus. And that truth then is immutable, which means unchangeable. It doesn't change with time. There can be things that are relatively true. For example, it is true for me that I like chocolate ice cream better than I like mint. Now, I like them both, don't get me wrong, but I like one better than the other, and it's possible that my taste can change over time. There are things that I didn't like as a child that I came to like as an adult in foods, and so we're talking about food again. See what you did? But we're really, when we're talking about truth, and we're not talking about fashions and foods and general preferences here. There are things like that that change over time, and we can have relative truth to that from that standpoint. Personal preferences are different from objective standards, however. What we're discussing is what some might call true truth, truth with a capital T. And personal preferences are not that. Objective standards remain objective. Whether we like them or not, whether we've changed personal preferences or not, I might change over time in my thinking about something. That doesn't change the standard. So if what we're considering here is a personal or changeable preference, then it's not the truth with a capital T. So it is objectively true, for example, that murder is immoral. That doesn't change over time. It's objectively the case that assaulting others is wrong. Racism is objectively evil because it violates the dignity of humanity created in the image of God. These types of matters are true because of what we find reflecting the reality of God Himself. This is the way God is, and truth reflects Him. Speaking in a context of judgment and God's faithfulness, God declared in Malachi 3:6, "I, the Lord, do not change." God is faithful. His declared truth will match His nature. So, for example, when God declared His oath to Abraham, it was good as done because it was impossible for God to lie and His purpose is unchangeable, according to Hebrews 6:15 through 18. Likewise, Jesus again saying, "I am the truth." He is unchangeable in His faithfulness, Hebrews 13 and verse 8. The Lord is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Since truth is based on God's immutable character, then that which is changeable and contrary to God's nature will not be the truth we're talking about or seeking here. But truth is also universal. Personal preferences are limited, changeable, and they're local to me. These are my preferences. They may not be your preferences. Maybe I like one color, maybe you like a different color. Maybe I like one kind of fashion, you like another kind of fashion. That's okay. And we understand that we can live together that way. But truth, true truth, truth with a capital T, is universal. It's truth regardless of who or where or what or when we are. God's will is universal. If He desires all to come to a knowledge of the truth, 1 Timothy 2 and verse 4, then that same truth about sin and salvation applies to everyone regardless of who they are or where they are, regardless of what language they speak or what time in history they lived or anything like that. He's not reaching out only to one group or one nation now, but Jesus came into this world to die as a propitiation for all the world. 1 John 2 and verse 2 reminds us the need for salvation is as universal as the need for sin or the problem of sin. And the means of salvation through Christ is as universal as God's expressed will. So moral truth, the truth that God reveals about the way that He expects us to live, is going to be universal. That which is good or evil is equally applicable across time and place. Again, murder is always wrong, regardless of who we are or where we are. Love as a virtue is always right, everywhere and for everyone. But truth is also foundational. Truth must be at the baseline of a worldview if our worldview is going to be meaningful. What is at bottom? What is at the foundation of everything that we think and do? If what is at bottom is false. Now, remember what we quoted Richard Dawkins a few minutes ago where he said, at bottom. That's worldview language. at the foundation, at bottom, there is no good, no evil, just pitiless indifference, he said. That's the atheist worldview foundation right there. And by the way, that's what Jesus would call sand. It's not a solid foundation on which to build anything. So if it's false, it's not going to stand as a viable option for how we ought to be living our lives. But that requires then that truth be self-consistent. If we believe something that is self-contradictory, then we know that can't be the truth. A worldview based on a no-truth foundation will fail. And the only foundation that can stand ultimately will be based on a foundation in truth. That's highlighted by Jesus in the well-known thing that he tells in Matthew 7, 24 through 27. Whoever hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock. That's foundational right there. You build your house on the rock. The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew, slammed against that house, and it did not fall, for it had been founded on the rock. And of course, for us, the rock is capital R. He's the rock on which we build our lives. And he says, everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like the foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew and slammed against the house, and it fell, and great was its fall. So truth is grounded in Jesus Christ and in his expressed will. And so Christians, of course, should be really concerned about living their lives in truth. Not only do we want to tell the truth, in other words, we don't want to be liars, but we are the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support of the truth. And that's foundational to who we are and to whom we have our complete allegiance. So, just on a practical level here, how can faith keep our feelings in check? Because that's the danger, again, that we see. Our feelings begin to take over, truth becomes diminished, and our feelings take the lead and decide, you know, we begin to decide that this is what's true for me, and I can do what I want. 1 John 5 says in verse 1, whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God. Whoever loves the Father loves the children born of him. By this we know we love the children of God, when we love God and observe his commandments. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. For whatever is born of God overcomes the world, and this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith. We've talked briefly, used the word faith and talk about that, but we somehow have the mistaken notion that faith is just directed feelings without or in spite of evidence. And that could be further from the truth, biblically speaking. Faith is a trust that is built on the facts. Faith is the demonstration of a conviction in the reality, the truth of what we cannot see. We all have faith in something. Faith does not just... It should not be something just at our whim that we decide I'm going to believe it and then it doesn't matter what the evidence is. Faith does direct our feelings, but biblical faith is not disconnected from truth. Truth is always first. Truth is primary. Truth supersedes and takes precedence over your feelings. And yet faith can latch on to the truth and redirect our feelings in a way that keeps them in check and honors those feelings appropriately. It also means that faith can act even when feelings might take us in another direction. So, for example, I might feel angry and hurt about something, and in my anger, I may be tempted to lash out in a fit that will be destructive to others and to myself. Faith, however, can make me take a pause, to back off and think it through and say, no, this is a work of the flesh. I want to please God. I need to show my love for others. I'm not going to act out on these destructive feelings. So because of trust in God and His Word, we can stave off disastrous circumstances that may come through an expression of unchecked feelings. So here's what faith does. Faith redirects our minds to God and His Word so that we'll trust who God is and what He said. Am I willing to trust what He said about something? Then we're reminded of our relationship to both God and others. Faith then can recall how we ought to be thinking and acting. This is what I ought to do in this circumstance. This is, and my relationship with God and others is at stake. Even though I may feel hurt, I can then choose to act in a godly way, even if my feelings aren't there. And the feelings will come around As you know, feelings are like a roller coaster. They come and go. They ebb and flow. But faith can overcome those problems that arise through feelings, because we can look at what God says and practice habitually what He says through a godly mindset. If you've been raised up with Christ, keep seeking the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things that are on the earth, for you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, is revealed, you will be revealed with Him in glory. Faith helps me choose the right path, even when I might feel differently. Post-truth may be the word of the year in 2016, but truth will always be the word for the child of God. Nature of truth is that it is objective, it is real, it applies equally to everyone, and we can discover it and attain it and live it. To determine truth, we determine these characteristics about truth and know that we're dealing with something that is real and objective. And may God help us to be noble-minded, like the Bereans, that we eagerly and willingly seek out His truth. And apply that to our own salvation now, as we're going to prepare to sing a song here in just a moment, if you'll get your songbooks ready. If I ask you the question, how do you know you're saved? What would your answer be? If your answer is, well, because I just feel it, can your feelings be wrong? Yeah, that's not the right answer. I hope you feel saved, but that needs to be based on the truth, and the truth comes first. And so the point is, I can know that I'm saved because I can know objectively what God's Word says, and I can know whether I've obeyed. It's not because I've done anything great. It's not because I've earned anything. But I trust the promises of God. And here's what He promised, and here's what He commanded. The question is, have you done that? Feelings will follow. They are not the guiding factor in knowing, but they certainly are wonderful to have after you've done the truth. So maybe tonight you need to obey the gospel. Maybe you need to be baptized into Christ. Maybe you need the prayers of this congregation. I don't know your particular circumstance, but I would just beg you not to walk out of this building tonight uncertain about where you stand with God. So if we can help you, let us know. Let's stand and sing.